Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is the last talk of the 2010 Range Retreat. So this retreat is coming to its conclusion. There's always another one coming next somewhere or other, so it's not really an ending. But nevertheless, this period of time when we've been together meditating, practicing Dhamma, arguing, messing around, sleeping too much, eating too much, the usual stuff, but also we've hopefully gained a lot of progress on our path towards enlightenment. And somebody was mentioning to me just a couple of days ago or yesterday, sort of, you know, have we got it right? Just what's the difference between being comfortable and being indulgent? And of course that's the importance of the middle way. To find just that right amount of effort, not too much effort. Because you just become then the control freak. And you get this tightness and tension which goes opposite to the path we're supposed to be progressing on. This is the path, most of all, of abandoning your sense of self. Abandoning this ego. And of course you know that most of your controlling, if not all of it, comes from this sense of ego. You may not see it. But if you trace it back, it always comes from this I who wants to attain something and get something and get one's own way or just avoid the problems of life or to gain some attainments. It all comes from the sense of self, and that's why it doesn't work. It's coming from totally the wrong place, and it's much safer to let go of that controlling. So, you know, we learn how just to relax some more. And of course that does become comfortable. If you go too far to the sense of indulgence, now that's, you can tell it's indulgence because it's a sense of sluggishness to the body, sluggishness to the mind. It's not sharp, it's not peaceful, it's not joyful. And in fact, it's the joyfulness, the happiness, which I always find is the greatest indicator of the fact you have got the right balance there between comfort, indulgence and asceticism. Because that sense of happiness and joy which one can develop, you know, in a monastic situation, that is just crucial to the path. On last Saturday, I talked about the gradual training to the Anagarikas and Buddharakata and the lay guests, all about the development of happiness. I mentioned that the gradual path first occurs in the usual way that the suttas are ordered in the second sutta of the Digha Nikaya, the Manyapala Sutta, where it's called the fruits of the holy life. And of course some of you will be going home to your families or wherever soon, and people will be asking you, what did you get out of this retreat over here? Why have you spent just 3 months in this place? What fruits do you get here? And the Buddha's answer to King Ajatasattu was just in the sense of the happinesses which come from the various levels of practice. But of course the first level of practice, you know, was the precepts, the sila, living simply, having few possessions, as he says in that gradual training. So wherever you go, you just take your bowl and robes with you like a bird. So those of you who are leaving, how much are you taking with you? Please, take less than you came with. Not more, because then you just become just like an ordinary person in the world, someone who accumulates things. Take less. And I don't just mean with your physical possessions, even with your emotional possessions as well. Make sure you leave things here. Well, not leave things in the storeroom, leave them in the dustbins, in the trash cans. Discard these things. So you leave with less than you came, that you are lighter, more free. So the virtues which we keep here, the idea of forgiveness, the idea of not carrying any sort of ill will from who said what to who and when they did it, that degree of virtue gives you a very great sense of happiness. And it's that happiness which one develops, the happiness dependent upon letting go of things. Of course, it's that happiness which is depending on having stuff, you know, having your iPods, having your sort of TVs, you know, having your all this other sort of stuff, your family, your friends or whatever. That type of happiness, because it's dependent upon other things, is very, very uncertain. When you lose your stuff, you've lost your happiness and you get very upset. So the happiness which we're talking about is a happiness which is based on letting go, based on simplicity. What it actually is like an underlying happiness, a happiness which you may look upon as being like a ground state, always there, and we cover it up with negativity. All we need to do is to let go of things, to free ourselves of all these burdens, and then that happiness shines through. Or just like the full moon covered by the clouds, when the full moon's always there, that happiness is, in a sense, is always there. It gets covered up with the clouds of negativity, with the clouds of planning and remembering the past, and with the clouds of thinking and fantasizing. And if we could only just let all of that go, to restrain ourselves, to let go, to simplify, then you find that you can just have this beautiful sense of happiness. And if anybody asks me just, you know, why are you a monk? Very often I said, for the sake of happiness. And they say, well, happiness, how can you be happy as a monk? Just go outside, get a life, get a girl, see movies, go places, do things. And of course, many of you have been there, have done that. You know, even in the 60s and 70s, you can get much of life out of the way by the time you're 23. You know, your sex, girlfriends, drugs, rock and roll, all that sort of stuff. Been there, done that by the time you're 23. So I'm sure that these days you can do it much quicker. So it's very efficient. So get all that out of the way, realize that that's not going to get you anywhere, and look for happiness in a much more authentic place. You know, just restraints, precepts. And that's a very powerful statement which is not emphasized enough. For all of you in this monastery, it doesn't matter whether your meditation has been nimittas and jhanas, or you've just been having struggle just watching your breath just for 5 minutes or even 1 minute. Nevertheless, you've developed a lot of restraint with your precepts. You know, you've actually just lived very simply for the last 3 months. You know, you have spoken kindly to one another most of the time, spending a lot of time in solitude, giving and sharing and caring for one another. So you've actually done a lot of virtuous practice. And you find that does give you a happiness. Sometimes when you stay in this monastery, when you have other people of the same level of happiness, you just take it for granted. When you go outside into the world and see what other people are up to, just look how many other people are smiling when you see them in the shopping centres. See just how many people have got that same sense of lightness to them, which, you know, you have when you stay in this monastery. And so you realize that just keeping this virtuous practice, which we all do here, you know, not perfectly, but certainly good enough, gives you this beautiful sense of what they call anavajasukha, which is the blameless happiness. I always think of sila as just, you know, when the sila gets stronger and stronger and stronger, it's just like the tide comes in and the sea level rises. What's actually happening there, your average level of happiness is going up. Sure, you have your good days and your bad days, but the average level just rises. You actually feel more happy and more content on average. Sure, you get your bad days, but your good days, but your bad days aren't as bad as anymore, and your good days get really good, really high. That's the nature of the mind. And the reason I'm talking about this happiness, because once one reflects and sees that, yeah, there is a sense of happiness here just by keeping precepts, it does give you an idea of the benefits of monastic life, of staying here for a while. sometimes I agree that, I confess this, I just really focus on meditation a lot, because that's a core part of our practice here. But even if your meditation is not so hot, the very fact that you're just keeping very, very good precepts, sometimes you might be very sort of thinking, what is he talking about? He doesn't really know me. I know what you get up to, but look, you're not that bad. Sometimes that when people look at themselves, they're far too critical of themselves, and sometimes they get down upon themselves. But you've been really great sangha and great lay people this retreat. Your precepts, your sila has been very high. So, understanding that, rejoice in it. In other words, by saying rejoice in it, recognize there is an underlying happiness there. A happiness of, look, you've lived a very good life for the last 3 months. You've been keeping these precepts. You haven't been going around harming animals or harming other beings. At least not that much. And you have been living a simple life, a frugal life. You haven't been just going around buying stuff all the time and just accumulating possessions. You've been actually letting go of things. And that gives you this beautiful sense of the happiness born of freedom. So recognize that. When you recognize that, that gives you a sense of, you've got something. There's something fulfilling, something worthwhile out of staying in a monastery like this. Much better than a retreat center. This is a monastery, and here in this monastery, those precepts, they do have a power. It's one of the reasons why people come and feed us and why they enjoy coming to this monastery. They ask them, and sometimes I ask them, what do you come here for? And they say, for the peace. They just love coming around happy people. And sometimes you think, maybe other people are happy but not me. But no, you are happy. Look, it's in my whole life that when I was, when I wanted to become a monk, I went off to this temple in London, Wimbledon Temple. No, sorry, it used to be Wimbledon Temple. In those days, it was an Isshin Buddha Pradipa. One day, the monks there told me, there's a monk who's just this robe. He's just come from Thailand. And so I went up and talked to him. Where did you come from? Do you know any good monasteries over in Thailand? Because I'm going to become a monk, and I want to go to a nice monastery. And he just sort of ummed and ahed. He never really said very much. And so I didn't get much information from him, actually no information at all. And so, eventually I went over to Thailand and just to a big monastery in Bangkok, and I was fortunate to meet some monks from Wat Pa Phong. Went up there, and when I met Ajahn Chah after a few days, decided that's where I wanted to stay. And about a year later, that guy I saw in this temple in London came to visit. And when reason he came to visit, because I found out that he was an ex-Wat Pa Phong monk. He'd ordained there and disrobed. When I saw him, I said, look, why didn't you tell me about this place? And his response was, when I met you, you were smiling, you were too happy. I didn't think you were serious. And that's actually what he's saying, that he thought that you had to be serious. If you had a smile on the face, you're not serious about becoming a monk. He just had got no idea that this path is a happy path, a path without groaning. I think, and later on, the monks who know something about meditation know that those people who are happy, they're the ones who are going to sort of get some very deep meditation and get some enlightenment experiences. You can tell after many years, those people who are negative, misery guts, always putting people down, getting angry, those are the people who are not going to get anywhere in your meditation. It's a general rule. So we cultivate that happiness, and the first happiness is from precepts. So if you go around smiling a lot, that's a good sign your meditation's going well. That's also why, as a teacher, sometimes that, we have interviews, and I ask you how you're going. And I just still remember this time during a 9-day retreat, when I was talking to a couple of these meditators, and, I said, how are you going? Interview. And, they looked sort of actually quite miserable. But when I asked them and said, why, what's happening? And they said, I can only get second jhana, I can't get third. And that's what they said. And I looked at them, you haven't got any jhana at all, not second, third, or first, not even a fraction of one. Now, because if you get meditation, you're blissed out, and you can tell by the smile on your face. If you're keeping precepts, you get happy. So a lot of time you can tell sort of where a person's at by their happiness level. So you can tell where you're at by your happiness level. This is karma vipaka, the result of your karma. You've been keeping lots of precepts, you've been doing well. You get this beautiful sense of happiness, let alone for meditation. So that's an encouragement for each one of you. Even if you don't get far with the meditation, just keeping precepts is well worthwhile. Even if you just even spend your whole life as a monk and never get one nimitta, the very fact you stay here and keeping precepts and keep the precepts well means you know you deserve the food you get, I say. It means you know you are a good example in this world, where sometimes you can't trust other people, they can trust you. Where other people can let them down, you know that you've got this high sense of morality. So you know you'll try your very best. Sure, you know, sometimes you make mistakes, but your intentions are reasonably pure. And you're a person who's harmless. They say a person who keeps precepts gives others the gift of fearlessness. It's a type of dana, abhaya dana it's called. A type of giving which, you know, the monks, the novices, even the anagarikas can give. And even the lay visitors can give to our people who come into this monastery. They know that when they come in here, they don't have to fear like you're going to rob them or kill them or hurt them or cheat them or do whatever. Sure enough, sometimes we cajole $11 out of them for the calendars. But I mean, that's a bit of fun and games. We're not really sort of putting the hard word on them. So in other words, they can come in here without fear. That's only if we keep precepts. I remember just, again, this is first year at our monastery in Thailand, when some of our Western monks, yeah, we were trying to be monks, but we didn't really get it, some of us. And I do remember our first treasurer, and he was a very, very devoted man. He was a medic, still remember his name, Morpania. And he would come and bring food once a week, and he would be our treasurer, look after things. But then he stopped coming. He stopped coming for months. And I was going to this ceremony in another monastery and just being ascetic. I said, I'm not going in the car. I'm going to walk and just see if people give me a lift. And in those days, you'd be walking down these dirt roads and Thai people were so kind. You know you're going to get a lift. And this guy was actually stopped and he recognized me walking down, going to a ceremony in another monastery in my bowl and robe and my little yarn. And he said, I'll come in, I'll give you a lift. And then I was very pleased to see him again. So why haven't you been coming? And he told me quite honestly, he said that he was afraid to come in to Wat Nanachat. Because every time he'd come in there, someone would ask him to do something. Ask him for an errand, just to post this letter, or can you get me some more stamps, or I need a more battery for my flashlight. And he said he spent so much time running errands for the monks, he didn't have any time for his own work. And his own family. He was so afraid to go into that monastery because he couldn't say no and it would take up so much time. It was a classic case of what we read in the suttas, of that when the lay people saw brown cows coming in a distance, they thought they were monks and so they shut their doors, they hid in case the monks would ask them for something. So that was in my own life, I saw that happening. And so when we live very simply, when we don't ask for things, we give this fearlessness to our lay supporters. We're getting on to the Katina time now. People come up and they keep asking me, Ajahn Brahm, what can I get you? What can I get you for your birthday? What can I get you for this? What can I get you for that? And it's wonderful when I say, nothing, I don't need anything. It's a bit disappointing for those lay people, but I'm setting a standard there. You know, there's stuff in the storeroom, and there's heaps of stuff in the storeroom. Poor old Ekagata just has a hard time fitting it all in and tries to get rid of it all. He's our store monk. Isn't it wonderful to have such few possessions? And you know, that every time that happens to me and somebody asks me, and I really try my hardest to try and find something which I need. And I can't think of anything. That gives me so much happiness. the happiness of frugality. It's very rare that you can actually find anybody like that. That inspires a lot of people too. And if someone comes up to you and says, you know, you've done a really great favor for me. What can I get you personally? It's just for you. And say, nothing. I've got everything I need. Don't you know that's contentment and that's such a rare thing to find in this world? Because always people need things and they haven't got enough and they need this and they need that. But you're as a monk saying, no, I've got everything I need. This is good enough. Now that is very impressive. That gives me happiness and it gives fearlessness to other people. They can come up to you and they know you're not trying to get anything out of them whatsoever. You're just trying to give. Now that type of morality, which we emphasize in this monastery, is a very, very beautiful thing. Fearlessness to other beings. You're not trying to get anything from them. When you sort of go close to the cat's bowl, the cat doesn't have to guard their bowl because you're not trying to steal anything from them. From the kangaroos, you're not trying to get anything from them. From the birds, from the other people, you're not trying to get anything from them. That fearlessness which you give people is very rare, precious, and one of the reasons why people like supporting us, why we get so many people coming here. When you ask for things, they don't like coming. When you don't ask for anything at all, fearlessness means they want to try and always bring you the best. So by that sila, that virtuous practice, we don't just get happiness, we create so much happiness in this world. But especially the happiness which we get for ourselves, we can reflect upon that. And we can reflect upon our giving, our service, what we're doing for others. And that's a huge benefit for our well-being. Many people in this world suffer depression, they suffer this terrible sense of lack of self-worth, simply because they don't create enough happiness in their own hearts, in their own lives. I've often told people who are depressed, you know, forget about the Prozac, forget about the sort of even trying to meditate. Don't do some service for other people. You do some service for other people. You know, you help do some weeding at the retreat center. You know, you do some sweeping of the grounds. You know, you just cook or you help clean up for somebody. Just a little bit of service for others gives you an enormous boost of happiness. And there's plenty of places which need some service. Why does it overcome that depression? Because when you really help other people, when you give, when you serve, you're creating this beautiful sense of worth, value, that you've actually done something wonderful for other people, for the world. When I get tired, and that's quite often, I'm getting old and I still have lots and lots of duties to perform, I only have to have a look around and just see what I've done in the past 36 years as a monk. In this hall here, I just have to look at the bricks which I've laid just on the top of the wall over here in the corner, the apex. I'll never forget, because it was traumatic, just climbing up to the very tip of that wall behind the Buddha statue when there was just a freestanding wall. There's no roof on, nothing to hold it. And having just no scaffold, just coming from the end and climbing up to the top to do the last two or three bricks on there. If anyone had seen me, especially any supporters, they would have died of a heart attack. I almost died of a heart attack. You're climbing up this huge wall right to the very top corner, just with a bucket of cement in one hand and bricks in the other hand. Nothing to balance you or hold on. But you did that just out of faith. It worked. I didn't fall off. But of course, as I often mention, the people who do fail, they don't tend to talk about it because they die. Only the survivors tell these stories of faith. But anyway, I did that. But I look upon it now and I think, wow, I did that. And that gives me so much happiness. And that happiness is a beautiful sense of energy. So all of you who have served in the kitchen, who have washed up, who have washed my robes, who have cleaned the bowls, who have made a cup of tea, you know, with condensed milk, especially, that's great joy if you've done that. You know, you've given me that energy so I could serve and help people and, you know, give talks. So, you know, you get a piece of the action. You know, you've looked after this place. When you get to understand the, you know, just the power of giving, that's when you really understand to see it's actually a privilege to be invited by Nicholas to actually join in the clean-up of the kitchen. Oh, thank you so much, Nicholas, Anagarika Nicholas, to give me this great opportunity to help clean the kitchen. It's not the thing, oh, I don't want to be in the kitchen, I want to be meditating. No, it's just giving. It's making service, doing something for others. That's selflessness. That's letting go of the ego. That's letting go of control and doing something which is beautiful for others. That gives you happiness. And that happiness, and I say that's what I do to create happiness when I'm tired. Just look at the stuff which I've done, how many people you've helped and looked after. And when you start thinking about that, then your meditation takes off. So if your meditation hasn't taken off, you know, this rains retreat, it means you didn't spend enough time in the kitchen washing up and cleaning and doing stuff for others. You didn't have enough karmic power behind your meditation. So don't forget sort of this precepts and this dana which we do, and that creates this great sense of happiness. It's like spiritual power. And once you have that spiritual power, then you can meditate. Sometimes even I sit in my cave and think, why does meditation happen sometimes? Why doesn't it happen other times? And you know, one of the people in the interviews, you know, when they mentioned this, I focused on this and I told them, like, this is important. That's a great insight. When you're happy, when you're elated, meditation is easy. The Buddha kept on saying this, and you know it's one of my favorite sayings, and the reason it's a favorite saying is because this is crucial to the path. You know, Sukhino Chittang Samadhi Ati. From happiness the mind becomes still. From happiness, from joy, from elation, from feeling good about yourself, good about the world, good about the monastery. From happiness the mind gets still. From negativity, the mind gets restless. It escapes. From negativity, it gets dull. From negativity, it gets into craving. This is another escape mechanism. But when you're happy, and you create that beautiful sense of happiness, it's easy to meditate. Child's play. You just sit there and, oh, this is just so nice. I'm not going to go anywhere. So developing that sense of happiness is essential to the path. So when it comes up, nurture it. Grasp it. And I'm saying this carefully. In other words, don't throw it away. If it's the happiness which is, comes from beautiful things like your precepts, like your generosity, like your service to the community, translating books, looking after, just helping with other people's translations, whatever duty you've done in this past 3 months, for monks, senior monks, novice monks, looking after the water supply, even though there hasn't been much rain. Without you, there would be no rain in the tanks at all. So don't think of these things as small. Cultivate them, dwell upon them, until they bring out this beautiful sense of happiness. Once that happiness is there, then you can start watching your breath or whatever other meditation object you need. Develop the happiness first. So sometimes that becomes your preliminary duty. You know, you sit in your hut or in your cave, wherever you meditate, develop joy first of all. Joy by reflecting on all the goodness, all the service you've done. If there's not enough joy there, get off your seat and do something. Wash a dish or sweep something or other. Do something which is a service for others. And then once, I really get into this. I mean, when I was a young monk in Thailand, I loved doing services for other people. You get so much fun out of it. You know that old story of Ajahn Chah? This is an Ajahn Chah story. I haven't told this for quite a few years. First time I went to Wat Pa Pong, there's no Wat Nanachart then, it was before Wat Nanachart was founded. So we'd be in Wat Pa Pong, and there's only a few branch monasteries, maybe four or five of them in those days. So it was in the very early years of Wat Pa Pong. And so most of the monks would be sitting, you know, in Wat Pa Pong in this dining hall, which was like a long chamber, just with monks on either side, and just maybe about a meter and a half in between, just for bringing the food down. And anyhow, just every morning after we'd come back from alms round, we'd empty our bowl, we'd only be allowed to keep rice, and we'd sit down, and then we'd wait for Ajahn Chah to come in. And when he came back from alms round, you know, we always had no shoes on alms round, keeping the old tradition. All these monks would jump up to wash his feet. And of course, I thought that was absolutely ridiculous. You know, it was just one of these stupid Thai traditions of washing feet. You know, because I thought he was old enough now to wash his own feet. And not only that, but I mean, there was about 10 monks on each foot. And, you know, you're a Westerner, you think, well, what should we do? Let's have, like, we have dana rosters. Let's have a roster. You know, so one monk goes on Monday to wash his feet, another the next one. Because it must be much more convenient. It must be terrible having your feet washed with all these people around you. So that's what I thought. But, of course, you know, my background is in science. I wanted to try it out. So it's one day I tried it out. To wash Ajahn Chah's feet. And you had to be fast. You had to jump up. And, you know, you had to sort of, you know, bustle the other monks like in a footy, like to push them off so you can get something, to get the ball. And I actually managed to get a toe, all to myself. It's true, I always remember this. I managed to get a toe of Ajahn Chah and wash it. That's as much, that was actually quite lucky to get a whole toe for yourself. You know, that pissed me out for the rest of the day. It was weird. All I'd do was wash the toe of this old guy, you know, who didn't need his toes washed. He could do it very well himself, and it must have been very, very uncomfortable with a dozen pairs of hands around just one foot. But you got a whole toe and you washed it, and just that amount of service and reflecting on what you've done just gave me so much happiness. And that was where I realized just the power of this dana. And that's what I could do as a monk. You couldn't have money, you couldn't sort of make food and give food to people, but you could actually just give a little service like that to your teacher. And once I realized that, you realize just, it's not just sitting in your hut, cross-legged and watching your breath and thinking you can use, you know, all your skills and all of your effort and all of the stuff you've learned to try and focus. No, there's something more which was necessary before you can meditate deeply. And it was that happiness, that joy. And you're gaining it from simple things. So there's many days left. 2, 3, 4 days, I don't know how many, before we finish this retreat. Remember, recall the joy, the happiness of all the stuff you've done so far on this retreat. Deliberately. And then you find that at the beginning of the meditation, you're not tired. It's not a sort of a dull meditation anymore. You start from happiness, and it's so easy just to stay with the breath, because straight away it's a delightful breath, because your mind is delightful. I know there are times when just naturally you're happy, just something goes well in the day, or, you know, you get a letter from someone and it's good news, or you have just a beautiful meal, the sort of meal you like, or something happens and you get this sense of happiness, and meditation is just so easy. Even just, look, just a couple of nights ago I had a very deep meditation. You know where that meditation came from? I'd been suffering from hay fever, and it was so bad I decided to take some medicine. I don't usually take medicine. I took some medicine. And that just cleared up the hay fever. That gave me all this sense of relief and happiness. And I had a really nice meditation a couple of nights ago. And it's just happiness. And sometimes I'm stupid. I forget my own teachings. So give yourself a boost of happiness and joy. And then you get some nice meditations. And those nice meditations give you an opportunity to actually to understand how this whole thing works. I know sometimes people push and they struggle and they fight and they go through pain and stuff like that. Yeah, they get willpower, but I can't see how on earth they can get peace and this beautiful sense of piti sukha of the deep meditations. You start with a tiny bit of happiness. You know, happiness of, you know, you've done something beautiful and good. You know, you've done kip precepts, you've done dana. You just start with a small part of it. And then you just take that little flame and you build it up into a big bushfire of bliss. You just feel good about this moment, feel good about yourself. The busyness of fixing things up is gone. The negativity, the fault-finding mind, which causes you to try and control things, is gone. Happiness is okay. You can leave things alone. You can let go when things are going well. When there's problems and things to be done, of course you have to get involved. But when everything is perfect and beautiful and lovely because you've been dwelling upon the happiness, it's easy to let go. And when you let go and the happiness gets more, which makes it easier to let go. And the happiness gets into bliss, which makes it easier to let go. And the happiness just takes off. As long as you're not afraid of that happiness, you can carry on letting go. The happiness and the joy, which is built on letting go. And as you develop this, you just really go into the deep happinesses of the jhana and the deep happiness. Understand why the Buddha said that nibbanaṃ paramaṃ sukhaṃ. Nibbana is the ultimate happiness. And the only way you can really understand that is when you understand nibbana as cessation. Now, bhava nirodha, the cessation of existence, things disappearing, vanishing, gone. You understand that this is what happens when you let go. You let go a little, you get happiness, you let go a lot, you get bliss, you let go totally. And the sign of letting go is things cease, and you get blissed out of samsara, nibbana. So it is not just a case of happiness for happiness' sake. It's happiness which reveals the path of ultimate happiness, of ultimate reality. Ultimate reality is bliss. Bliss upon bliss upon bliss. And this is what's happening. You're going closer. So as you develop this monastic life or being in a monastery, you're developing the happiness of just being a harmless person and being a good person, being a restrained person who lives very simply, has few possessions and needs very little. You can chat with other people, they can tease you, you don't get upset. It's only just teasing, that's all, just monks being monks. You know, we're just human beings, we say our jokes and stuff like that. But, you know, it's just boisterous humour. So we do these things, but we just have this beautiful sense of joy and happiness. And with that joy and happiness, we realise that's part of being a monk. And as we develop that, just our precepts get more profound. We understand with insight why precepts, why we have all these rules, why we have all these restraints on us, why? It's because it's letting go. It's joyful. It creates greater happiness. That's why we keep these precepts. The precepts of simplicity. Some people say, why can't we just, you know, have a sandwich in the afternoon if we're hungry? That's why, you know, can't we have a back scratcher? We're not allowed, that's one of the rules, can't have a back scratcher. Well, that's stupid. It's only a back scratcher. Why? Because it blisses you out when you keep these rules. And you understand why. Why can't we just squash these stupid ants? Because harmlessness creates this beautiful sense of happiness. As you develop that, you understand that this is a path of happiness upon happiness upon happiness. And you see these beautiful people who practice that path for a long time. Some of the happiest people, the happiest people you've ever met. I'm talking about the average happiness. Yeah, sometimes they get a bit down, but average happiness of these Sangha members who've been there a long time is very impressive. And when you see that, that shows you that, yeah, this is not just theory, this is practice. And this is what you want. That's many people, they became monks because they saw other Sangha members and they wanted that happiness which they saw in others. They wanted that smile, they wanted that peace of an Ajahn Chah, they wanted that incredible sense of tranquility of an Ajahn Thet. They wanted that because that was showing them just basically the meaning of life, the happiness, the peace, the fulfillment. So you've got a lot of happiness in this retreat. And don't just sacrifice that because it may not have been exactly what you intended. It may not got the jhanas, but you got a lot of happiness. That's enough. That's good enough. Be content. And then the jhanas come. If you want them, no way. If you strive for them, no way. If you develop happiness, yes, they come. They're born of happiness. Happiness has to be their cause. Frustration, disappointment, no way can anything happen. So by developing the happiness, you get the jhanas. By developing the bliss of jhanas, mind is so powerful. You get the picture. The insight happens. You know, just what happiness is. What happiness is the end of dukkha. Sometimes it's just a simple statement, and sometimes people miss it. When suffering ceases, there's happiness. This is just the night and the day, the black and white. So as blackness disappears, the brightness comes. Which is why when you have heaps of happiness in your meditation or in your monastic life, it means a lot of suffering has disappeared. As you go deeper and deeper, more and more things disappear. Just more happiness, less suffering. Until the final end of suffering is when there's nibbana. That's why it's called paramangsukang, ultimate happiness, joy. What the Buddha called, Sariputta called, the end of an affliction. So here we're trying to end afflictions. We're not trying to attain things, but we're trying to end things. We're trying to let go of things, not to get more things. So we've come into the end of a rain retreat. Beautiful. We've got rid of another rain retreat. One less on your path to enlightenment. You've got it out of the way. But don't get happiness out of the way. Keep the happiness, keep the joy, develop it even more and more. Because happiness is essential to the path. It's certainly what really inspired me to sort of be a monk, to stay as a monk, for the sake of happiness, to be a connoisseur of happiness. Someone who understands the deepest happiness is of all. Once you touch the deep happiness and understand what happiness is, the happiness is born of letting go, not the happiness born of owning things like girlfriends, boyfriends, possessions, cars and videos and stuff like that, but the happiness born of being free, letting go, happiness born of having given, served, the happiness born of total contentment. That's the happiness of our monastic life. And each one of you, I'm sure, has gained a lot of happiness. Please reflect upon it, because that's like investing in the stock market, which always goes up. The happiness goes up and up until it goes right through the roof. So may you all have a happy time in the next few days and for the rest of your life, all the way to Nibbana, where you get the happiness which goes beyond all measure.
Namayam Vaidakataya Sarvikaram Dadamase
Saru, 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 Amuram.
Very good.
Arahai Sama Sambuddha Bhagava Purudan Bhagavatan Abhivade Suvakato Bhagavata Namo Dharma Namasami Supatipano Bhagavata.